sick and tired living in a town filled with narrow minds. And hey, they used to laugh at me. Their children.
All right, welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. That's 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number as Monday. It means Mondays with my co-host Sandy Williams. And Sandy, the banking crisis seems to be getting broader and a little more involved than what we were hearing early on.
Well, it does. You know, banking in a way is a, you know, with the government guarantees of deposits up to $250,000, the FDIC guarantee, it's kind of an easy business, right? It's like taking candy from babies. You can attract money because the government's guaranteeing, or the government has set up an apparatus, at least with the full faith and credit of the government behind it, to guarantee the deposits in banks. So people will gladly put their money in a bank up to $250,000. So then the bank can turn around and lend that out. So how else could you gather all those dollars that you could then in turn around and lend out at a profit other than in banking with those kind of guarantees behind it? The guarantees, when they were set up in the 1930s, were the product of a political compromise in which Mr. Stegall, a U.S. senator, persuaded Roosevelt that we ought to guarantee deposits, but in exchange for those guarantees, we're going to regulate the dickens out of these banks and make sure they don't get into risky businesses. We're going to require that they can't make investments on their own behalf. They can only make loans. They had all the restrictions of the Glass-Steagall Act, which in our wisdom we got rid of in the 1990s, letting the banks continue to basically have this easy process of raising money from the public, but we gave them all kinds of risky pathways to invest it. And the public has always, without taking banking 101, the public has always known in the back of its head that banks don't have every dollar that you deposit in them is not available for you to take out of them the next day if everyone in the bank decides to withdraw it. The public has always understood that 80% of that money might be out and lent out, but they all understand that, you know, if I need my money in the normal course of business, I'll be able to get it. And that's the way it works. If you need it in the normal course of things, you'll be able to get it. But if the normal course of things gets interrupted by a lack of confidence in the bank, and a lot of people start saying, I got to get my money out of that bank, the bank's going to run dry of cash. They're going to have to dip into their capital. That's what happened to Silicon Valley Bank. They had to dip into capital. Their capital was diminished by having been invested in these long-term maturity bonds that had lost value. Bingo. We have a bank run that needs to be to be saved by the FDIC. The government stepped in and said, you know, with respect to these banks in trouble, we're going to guarantee all their deposits. Well, I last week thought that would be sufficient. But I hadn't really thought about the fact that Dodd-Frank, when it was enacted, didn't give the president and the Federal Reserve the power to make that promise unilaterally to all banks. It requires that the promise only be made to troubled banks. So, you know, if there's three troubled banks, the Fed can say, yep, these three troubled banks, all their deposits are covered. But it left open this question of whether that promise would and could be made to all banks. It takes Congress action to make the promise to all banks, and otherwise it's only going to be to troubled banks. And so that left a little bit of doubt. So there is still a continuing possibility of U.S. banks. The result of that was that these regional banks that are viewed as somewhat weaker than the big banks have had a run on this in the stock market with respect to the sell-off of their stocks. And they've also had a process of it being harder for them to raise debt capital when they need it to raise liquidity, not from the stock market, but from the debt market. So regional banks are in a little bit of trouble. And that little bit of trouble is enough to infect them with a sense of risk that might cause more potential for runs on those banks. Then another shoe falls. And that is that the Swiss bank, an international bank, which has had all kinds of trouble over the last couple of years, began to have more trouble with respect to the international people saying, you know, if it's These international banks, like Swiss Bank, don't have the same kind of guarantees as the FDIC. Maybe we need to start taking our money out of a bank like Swiss Bank. And so there began to be a withdrawal of deposits from Swiss Bank to the point where it became at risk, and its stock value fell way down. And over the weekend, the U.S. government, along with the Swiss government, stepped forward and said, you know what, the Swiss government, you better step forward and save this bank, because if a bank the size of Swiss Bank collapses, it'll be the kind of calamity that we worried about with and that was the result of the Lehman Bank collapse, and there'll be all kinds of echo effects. And so, yep, now the world is stepping in to save Swiss Bank, then we have Republic Bank in the United States, a regional bank that's being in the process of being saved. So my point is, this risk of a contagion remains, and a contagion in the banking world, if it really were to take hold and there really were to be a massive run on banks, well, I do think the federal government would make good on all those guarantees, but the federal government having to come up with that kind of billions, hundreds of billions, potentially trillions of dollars to protect the banks could put the dollar at risk, okay? And if the dollar got to be at risk in terms of the respect that it is accorded by U.S. Owners of dollars as well as world owners of dollars, now we have a serious, serious problem.
The tragic part of all of this, Sandy, is the disrespect to the American people. They just created laws because of the collapse in 2008 to protect the American people, supposedly.
Well, I think this is the ultimate problem of K Street, okay? It was lobbying of banks that caused the Glass-Steagall Act to get withdrawn under the Clinton administration. With the support of the Clinton administration, it was one of the last big bipartisan things that were done. And like I said last week, if it's bipartisan, look out. Okay, because if it's got lots of bipartisan support, either the lobbyists in Washington don't care about it at all, or the lobbyists in Washington are behind it. And the banking industry was like, let's get rid of all these unpleasant restrictions on us so that we can flex our muscle, we can take all this easily obtained deposit assets, and we can begin to invest them much more profitably than all these kind of cumbersome loans that we make as banks, because the Glass-Steagall Act was designed to cause banks to trade off this ease of access to deposits with a restriction that they would basically restrict their business to what they're good at, which is making loans.
So, Sandy, the part that is so discouraging is you're talking about the us, we're the them. And so the us continue to dictate to what happens to the them and what happens to our lives. Because if the bailout happens again, what's to say that this is not going to repeat itself, because lobbyists aren't there for the benefit of the them, us.
Well, that's the problem is, like, so Dodd-Frank gets enacted in 2008. Then lobbyists in 2018 are able to get a rollback of a bunch of the restrictions on regional banks. And like I said last week, these regulations are there to protect the public. They were also there to protect the banks from themselves.
But they didn't protect the public, because we're right back there again.
Well, they didn't protect them because they were rescinded by Congress.
But see, Sandy, so we didn't get protected because of the people we elected, who then made the decision to sell the people down the river.
Yes.
Okay, so how do we ever stop that? Because let's say they work this out, and 10 years from now, they'll come back and do the exact same thing. When is there ever going to be some real protection for the American people?
Maybe, this is awful, I don't want a financial collapse, but if we have a catastrophe that relates to the banking system, maybe the public will open their eyes and say, let's get money out of politics, because clearly money in politics is what got the Glass-Steagall Act rescinded. Money in politics is what got the 2018 Dodd-Frank rollback. And it was those rollbacks and that rollback of regulation and effective regulation that played a big role in these huge financial problems. And so maybe we can say maybe the public at large, and maybe even those businesses that are regulated will realize we should not regulate ourselves, because you know what? When we regulate ourselves, we might, some of us get profitable in the near term, but we open the world up and ourselves up to catastrophe.
You see, Sandy, this is why, as the average person and the American people who don't know, who trust, they don't realize that these people who we've elected are not looking out for their best interests. Again, 2008 was just, you know, a blip ago. And all those people who lost their homes, and there was this promise, never again. Never. We're close, or if barring a sneeze, we'll be back there again. And all of these people, the American people who work every day and struggle and have their families, and this has nothing to do with them, they're affected and impacted by it. That's the part of this, Sandy, that's so unforgiving to me. If you don't know, and we don't understand the inner workings of what's happening with the banking institutions and the systems, it's not for the average person to know. We just trust that.
Well, and one of the idiocies of the reaction to this bank problem is that it's now predicted that there will be a flight of money out of the regional banks that are viewed as weaker, and the money will flow into the very big national and international banks because they're viewed as safer. But what's really safe is a deposit that's less than $250,000. And those big banks, when the deposit flows to them, will basically get an increase in their percentage of deposits that are larger than $250,000, and the percentage of their deposits which are uninsured. And ultimately, I think in a bank risk situation, people are going to be looking at that percentage of uninsured deposits as a big bellwether.
Got to go to a break. Cassandra, Tom, we'll come to you. 844-967-2789. We'll be right back. So, welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. It's Monday. That means Mondays with Sandy Williams, and we're talking about the banking catastrophe that is happening. You were told that things were going to be safe, but clearly there's some things going on in the stratosphere that point to something bigger than what many thought it was going to be. Let's go to Cassandra from Middleton. Good morning to you, Cassandra. Thank you very much for calling. You say what?
Hi, Earl and Sandy. Thanks for taking my call. I'm enjoying the show. I just have two quick points to make regarding the banking crisis. I believe the mistake the Biden administration made was framing the problem as one in which the depositors had to be bailed out. Many of the people, especially the account holders in Silicon Valley Bank, they were not merely depositors. They were speculators, and there's a huge difference. Many of them, they were not just using that bank as the hometown bank to deposit their paychecks in order to pay their bills. Many of them were speculators. And And so I really do feel that the government did do a disservice to the American taxpayer, because these are people who had significantly more than the assured amount. And Sandy, I would like to know from you, why hasn't the government implemented a recovery fee? You know, when I go into the bank and I deposit a large check, I have to wait, you know, depending on the bank policy, anywhere from 5 to 7 business days for that check to clear. They'll give me a certain amount, but the rest is put on hold until it clears.
Yeah.
Why couldn't the banks establish some policy that if you want to withdraw funds over the over a certain amount, you have to wait 5 to 7 business days, and that gives the bank time to clear their records and make sure they're not put at risk. So that would be my first point. And then the second point, you all were talking about the BRICS countries, how Brazil, Russian, India, China, now Mexico, and Saudi Arabia, they all want to join the BRICS coalition. And I'm not quite sure if this is necessarily a negative outcome for the United States, because the United States can really step back and allow these other countries to be involved, because let's think about it. I think it could really help the dollar. All of these countries, when they complete their transactions and they have a profit or a revenue, where are they going to put their long-term assets in order to make interest or to grow, you know, from these transactions? You're not going to put it in Russia. You're not going to invest that money in China. You're not going to Brazil or India. That money is returning to the United States for long-term investment. So this is a little more complicated, and I think it could probably be a boon for the U.S. dollar. That's my opinion. I'll let you all listen off the air.
Thank you very much for the call, Cassandra. Sandy?
Well,
she said a lot.
She said a lot.
And we're coming up on a break,
yeah,
so go ahead.
On the first bite of it. The first end of it, the deposit issue, I don't quite understand why people who put, you're calling them speculators, except I guess if you put more than $250,000 in a bank, you would understand that only the first $250,000 was guaranteed. But they weren't speculating in order to make money. They were like every large corporation, not taking their money and breaking it up into $250,000 pieces and spreading it around. They were putting it in one bank or two banks where they have banking relationships. So I don't think it's fair to call it speculation. Number two, so far at least, the FDIC has been the entity that has been making good on the money. The FDIC gets its money from other banks and not from the federal government. It has the full faith and credit behind it of the federal government, but it charges premiums to banks, and the other banks will be the banks that pay for this in the circumstance of at least isolated bank failures. If we had a broad number of bank failures, the federal government would have to step forward and put its money into the FDIC, and we'd have a different circumstance. With respect to the BRIC nations, we weren't talking about that so far this morning. So let's
do this, Sandy, because it's going to take a little time to explain it.
Yeah.
844-967-2789 is the number. We're talking about the banks. Sandy Williams, it's Monday. Tom, I see you. We'll come to you. Be right back.
nice work. He can have these.
All right. Welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. That's 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. It's Monday. That means Mondays with Sandy Williams, and we are talking about the banking crisis that is almost turning into a crisis now. It certainly wasn't, as people started talking about it last week, didn't hear people talking about it being a crisis, but it's something that certainly has the capabilities of being that. Tom from L.A., thank you for waiting. You say what?
Well, Earl, first off, we the people ultimately are the government, and we must never forget that, or we are at least supposed to be. I am so disgusted today. I just want to puke. Over the greed and sloth and wrath and envy and pride and gluttony and lust, the seven deadly sins that this country is experiencing on a daily basis. How much is not enough? If we don't start having, honestly, some type of class war in this country, the 90% is going to lose everything. And we are going to be the paupers. We already are. If we don't start talking about things like Sandy talks about, the $60,000 average family, if we don't start talking about these things, it won't matter. You know, the rest of it, and climate change, that's a mess. And it's all about greed. All about greed. We are living in the world right now, the city of Babylon, as far as I'm concerned. And I wish there was some actual exterior force that would actually put everybody, because I'll tell you what, I know lots of rich people, they don't even know what the hell to do with the money that they have. They're so wasteful, they're so greedy, and these are people I call friends, and they're disgusting. Because of the fact that they're mentally ill. They have the same disease as someone that's a hoarder. And they have to hoard all the money, hoard all the cash. Like it's going to disappear on them or something. Just like the woman that I go and visit that has papers from on her counter all the way up to the ceiling and all over her house. She's a hoarder. But she's a hoarder in a different way. These are unbalanced, sick people. They happen to have some type of knack to screw the system or to be grifters. And I would just ask all of those people out there that are actually on the Donald Trump train or even the Republican train. And yes, Bill Clinton did screw up Glass-Steagall. There is no doubt about it. I can admit it when Democrats F up. But I'll tell you what, this Republican Party has done nothing. They're all bought off. They're all trying to get rich. And there's half the Democratic Party that's like that. And it is time that we the people take back the government. And it's time that we the people actually start a class war in this country and start getting our due. Because this is getting really disgusting. And it's all about greed. It's all about whatever it is for the big business or the billionaire class. I truly believe this. And they turn us against each other. And the thing is, all of us that are in the middle class and the upper to middle class and the lower class should all look at it and say, who am I closer to in income? I know I'm closer to the beggar on the street than I am to the billionaire class. And I'll tell you what, people better start realizing this and stop talking about transgender this and all this other crap and actually start doing something. Otherwise, we are not going to have a future.
Hey.
This country is going down. This world is going down.
Hey,
very
Tom,
fast.
Tom, thank you very much for the call. Sandy, let me ask you this question before. More than 97% of all the money in the economy exists as bank deposits, simply by making loans. Every time someone takes out a loan, new money is created. The Bank of England recently released reports explaining how this process works. Where does money come from? In the modern economy, most money takes the form of bank deposits. but how those bank deposits are created is often misunderstood. The principal way in which they are created is through commercial banks making loans. Whenever a bank makes a loan, it creates a deposit in the borrower's bank account, thereby creating new money. This description of how money is created differs from the story found in some economic textbooks, the Bank of England. The bank also released a video introducing the report available here, what the Bank of England says about money creation. Sandy, these...
Well, that's the way it works. You know, that's banking 101. If when you actually understand how banks work, you know, the deposit goes into the bank and then it gets lent out. And that money is lent out to someone else. Now there's $2 because I have my dollar deposited in the bank and I think I have a dollar. And then that same dollar is lent out to Jack. Jack has another dollar that he thinks he's got. So now $1 became $2. And those dollars all multiply like that. So there's a huge multiplier effect that the banking system has in creating perceived dollars, okay? And it's the perceived dollars that get spent, and they're fairly virtual. Fairly virtual in their nature.
Sandy, you said perceived dollars.
The dollar, people think of dollar as a piece of paper in your pocket.
Right.
Well, that piece of paper in your pocket, when it gets deposited in a bank, turns into bank deposits other places. It doesn't frequently get turned back into actual physical dollars. It gets transferred from place to place, and it becomes an accounting entry that's called a dollar. And those dollars get multiplied in that respect. And then sometimes people turn them back into cash, and they have to have dollars of cash to represent them. But the fact is that the banking system is central to this process, and that's why a collapse of the banking system has such a huge potential effect. I'm not Chicken Little. I don't normally predict dire things, and I'm not predicting a dire thing now. I'm simply saying that Pandora's box, we're peeking into it right now with the prospect of an international banking collapse. And I would simply say that an international banking collapse is essentially a dystopian outcome. It would be calamitous beyond any of our adult lives capacity to understand calamity. It would be a calamity beyond the 2008 crisis, because the 2008 crisis was a near collapse, okay? We were saved from it, but we didn't experience it. And the reason we were willing to spend all that money to bail out various financial entities was to avoid a financial collapse of banks. And so I'm simply saying an international banking collapse is a calamity beyond something we can comprehend. And what's a horror to me is that to some extent we've put ourselves in the direction of flirting with it because of what we've done to banking in the United States and across the world. And that is we've removed the Glass-Steagall restrictions on what banks can do. We've allowed banks to take much greater risks. We've allowed consolidations of banks into far fewer banks, so that, you know, it used to be that many small community banks didn't have deposits much bigger than $250,000. They were all safe as a rock, other than something truly stupid that some bank might do to itself in a manner that was essentially out of bounds to the rules, okay? But the situation is different today, and we've allowed it to get different as the result, I would assert, of money and politics. So I'm agreeing with Tom, certainly in that respect. And what we better do is we just better wake up and sober up to the fact that we need to pay attention to a lot of things internal to our country. We should stop paying all of our attention to wars abroad, to defense expenditures for the purpose of worrying about wars abroad that we might actually foment. And we should start worrying about things that are important to our country. And one of them actually is having politicians who are not compromised by money, who continue to look out for the public interest, who protect banks from themselves so that banks are protected for all of us.
You know, Sandy, and we, the we doesn't include, unfortunately, the person who stands to lose what little they do have and what they've built, been able to build, to just make it through on a daily basis. And when this what I think is a crime. If it's not a crime, it should be, because we just saw what took place and what transpired. And yet, here it is. We're right back at that precipice again.
Well, it's what we keep seeing is a reminder that Wall Street, this thing we talk about in this metaphorical sense, is not as smart as we give it credit for being. Banking is could be a very simple business, and it's very simple for them to gather all the assets they can gather together through deposits, okay, particularly guaranteed deposits. And now we're talking about guaranteeing much bigger deposits, and we better, in exchange for doing that, exact a great deal of restrictions in the form of much greater regulation on banking. We ought to be reverting to something much more like the Glass-Steagall Act. If we're going to make it so much easier for banks to get deposits so that we guarantee essentially all deposits of all size, then we better put a control over what banks do with that money.
Let's do this. Let's go to Stephen from Green Bay. Thank you very much for the call, Stephen. Appreciate it. You say what?
I actually have a comment, and then I have a question. The comment is, why don't more people take their money out of banks and put them in credit unions if credit unions aren't going through the same things as banks is going through? That's the question. And the comment is, Earl, I really appreciate you bringing this topic up, and I always sense the conviction and the, you know, wholeheartedness when you bring up topics, which I really appreciate. So thank you for that.
Well, so Sandy was the guy who pointed this out. I mean, we're going to talk about it anyway, because I'm a person who really looks at it that my life is being affected by these things. My family's life is being affected by these things, and I didn't have anything to do with it. So K Street, that Sandy keeps referring to, I have nothing to do with K Street, but yet K Street inflicts all of these things on our lives, and we can't change K Street. So when we talk about living in a democracy and we talk about the greatness of our nation, we keep seeing the same thing repeatedly happen over and over and over, and it's not criminal. Why shouldn't it be criminal? If these people can impact and affect our lives in the manner that they do, and we're talking about our great nation, then they need to make sure that this can't continue to happen. It's happening repeatedly, and yet we can't do anything about it. Well, it's K Street. Well, okay. But K Street, nobody told me when I read about our government that K Street controls our government. And if K Street is controlling the government and our lives, why? How come we keep allowing that to happen? Sandy.
Well, the quick question about the credit unions. Credit unions are essentially depositor-owned banks in a way. Credit unions do have a federal guarantee program, much like FDIC, that was installed more recently, so that deposits up to $250,000 in a credit union also are guaranteed. I would equate credit unions and small local banks as being more or less the same sort of risk profile. And what's surprising to me is that the financial community is now talking about migrating money towards very big national banks and a consolidation of banks to fewer and larger banks, when in fact those large banks probably have a risk profile that's much greater than the local small banks or credit unions. And as for the fact that this happens repeatedly, I mean, the fact is that the capital system has business cycles, and what we need to do is have regulations, which K Street seems to avoid.
All right, got to go to a break. 844-967-2789. We'll be right back. Sam, you know, the Earl Ingram Show. Sandy, I don't know what happened to the time. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. Text us at that same number. You know, Sandy and I were talking off the air about what has transpired here, and I was saying to Sandy that that should be criminal. What they did, taking away the protections of many of the American people's
resources.
Well,
and the day you're talking about is Congress.
Yes.
Yeah.
They changed the law. It was illegal. They changed the law where you couldn't say what they did was illegal. That still doesn't mean that the damage that they've created, that they should be able to walk away without having to pay a price for that, Sandy.
Well, I suppose that's one of the problems with legislatures and people who are in elected office. They're free to change the law. If they do so irresponsibly, or if they do so against the public interest because they've been essentially in some fashion compromised in their thought processes, there's no recourse against them other than to not elect them in the first place or to unelect them. And that's where we all have to wake up. And that's where Tom from California is absolutely right, that we need to do something as the electors to, one, get money out of politics, and two, to ignore the impact of money in politics by getting active and voting our interest to make sure that our interest is what's represented by the electors, but the people who are elected. But so far, not so good. You know, it hasn't worked so well.
You know, Sandy, the inner workings of our government, you always use the term complex. Man, we'll never understand the inner workings because some of the things are happening away from our purview. The decisions that were made, the average person, we're not looking and focusing on these changes that are monumental that are being made by our elected officials.
Yeah,
because it's out of our purview.
The problem is when it's complicated, it's subject to being affected by K Street because the public isn't going to be able to understand the complications. So the Dodd-Frank Act imposed a lot of complex kind of tests and restrictions on banks. One of the things was so-called stress tests, and it's even complicated to explain them. The banks were required to put themselves through all kinds of economic scenarios to make sure the bank could withstand all these different kinds of things, and some of these things would have exactly reflected the kind of scenarios that was ongoing in our economy recently, okay? But In 2018, the mid-sized banks banded together and said, look, if a bank's smaller than $250 billion, its failure wouldn't affect the national economy, and so just let us off the hook. Don't make us go through these processes, okay? So they got out of it. Guess what happened? The regional banks are now the ones that are getting thrashed on the stock market. The three banks that are the subject of failures recently in the United States are all regional banks that weren't subject to these tests. And so, yeah, you know, it was complicated. K Street got its way because it was essentially, when it's complicated, it's in the dark. It's like the whole tax code. Nobody understands the tax code. Tax lawyers have to study it to try and figure it out. And so it's perfect fodder for lobbyists to get their way within the tax code.
So, Sandy, as you stated, these things aren't criminal. It's a shame that they aren't, because when you can take advantage of people in that manner, that should be criminal. And just because K Street says it's not, and K Street is bigger and broader and better than any other American, apparently, they have more value than the average American, then you can get away with the kind of things that we're talking about here, right? Hey, Brian, I see you, man. You got anything you want to add to this?
You mentioned the idea of we earlier, and there's a collective we, and that we're closer to the person that is homeless than we are to the billionaire,
right?
Really. There's no better example of that. Would you say that this Congress is divided? Would you say that this legislature is divided? Maybe a little bit, you know, differing ideas of how to do things, let's say. Some might call it the most divided Congress in all of history, right? Well, back in the fall, when the railroad union decided to say, you know what, guys, we're not being treated fairly and we know our power. So let's go and exercise our power.
Yeah.
Do you know how fast that Congress yes. got together for a bipartisan thing? They're like, oh, no, 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 no. The workers can't have power. They can't. No, no. They came together so fast. There was that ideological divide just vanished as soon as they saw, oh, the workers are trying to do something.
Brian, that's why I've said when you've got bipartisan action, look out.
Yeah.
Because it's usually the result of K Street and not the result of the public interest.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, John Stewart was on the radio, on the TV recently, and he was interviewing an economist, and he was saying, you know, when we talk about gasoline prices going up, people like you, Sandy Williams, talk about how the marketplace needs to regulate prices, and we can't have the government regulate prices. But when wages go up, you guys all raise your arms and wave about the wage price spiral and how it's the cause of inflation. Well, how can that be, he said. It's prices going up that are the cause of inflation. It's not wages going up. And when wages go up, it's Tom, Dick, and Mary prospering. And when prices go up, it's corporations prospering. What's the story here? And you know what? That is very interesting. And it's interesting that our government has not spent more energy trying to figure out public policies that could work on controlling the business cycle without having the main onus be borne by Tom, Dick, and Mary.
I don't see why people don't see that every single person, if they make a little bit more money, will spend every single penny of that. We are programmed to do that already. We are a consumer society. Yeah. Every single person has a list of things they're going to buy if they hit the big one, right? So my point is, every single time we pour money into the lower part of the economy, they spend it right back, and it comes back, what, sevenfold, ninefold?
Man, you know, I hate we're out of time. But Sandy, as always, man, never enough time. The great thing is we'll see you again on Friday.
God willing.
All right. Thank everybody who made the show go. Thank Kevin, as always. Thank you, Brian. Thank the listeners. You've been tuned into the Earl Ingram Show. We'll be back on tomorrow.
Who's Kevin?
Huh? Who's Kevin?